So this is the third and final day of our three-day retreat here at the Franciscan Center in Tampa. What I'd like to do this morning is share some more Bankei with you. I think essentially you've gotten Bankei's message, and once you've gotten the message, it's just a matter of hammering it home. So in Bankei's tradition of just showing up and hammering, I will continue to hammer. But to share little teachings of his that get it from this way and that way. So today I'm reading from a book called Bankei Zen, Translations from the Record of Bankei by Peter Haskell. So this is a different, this was... Grove Press in 1984 is the first edition. So, again, I would imagine it's been reprinted, but I don't know. And as opposed to the other translation, this one kind of breaks it up into paragraphs, and they kind of pick and choose, and they're each kind of titled different things. The editor has done that. So listen deeply. Carefully. One day the Master addressed the assembly. All delusions without exception are created as a result of self-centeredness. This is unequivocating. Please pay attention. All delusions without exceptions are created by as a result of self-centeredness. When you are free from self-centeredness, delusions will not be produced. And then again, he does his example. For example, and actually I found something I'll read that'll give you a sense of what he means by delusions. For example, suppose your neighbors are having a quarrel. If you're not personally involved, you just hear what's going on and don't get angry. Not only do you not get angry, but you can plainly tell the rights and wrongs of the case. It's clear to you as you listen who's right and who's wrong. So not only when we don't dwell in self-centeredness do we not have the emotionality of anger and et cetera, but also we're very clear-headed and can clearly weigh the merits of all situations. But let it be something that concerns you personally, and you'll find yourself getting involved with one party or the other party, attaching to it, and obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of your Buddha mind. Before, you could clearly tell right from wrong, but now, led by self-centeredness, you insist that your own idea of what is right, whether it is or not. Does this sound familiar to anybody? And once again, he says, and then, becoming angry, you thoughtlessly switch your Buddha mind for a fighting demon, and everyone takes to arguing bitterly with each other. And again, this is, I think, if you want to take something away, this whole idea of transmigration, as opposed to be something that we do from lifetime to lifetime, it is something we do from hour to hour. Right? We start out, let's say we wake up in the morning, and for a brief moment, our minds are fresh, at ease, right? And yet, as we enter our day, before we know it, we are transmigrating through all the various states, the lower states of anger and resentment, of fear, of craving, of yearning, of stupidity, just animalistic impulses and basic needs going after to just wanting fame and wanting everybody to like us and to be noticed and to be known and to have power and to. Right, and have youth, and you know what I mean, beautiful things. I mean, we're just endlessly transmigrating. Okay? But he says, if you're looking for the cause is self-centeredness. Or as the other one translated in the other book, we're partial to ourself. Now he says, because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, the traces of everything you've done are spontaneously reflected. It's when you attach to these reflected traces And if you notice I sound a little differently, you notice I've been putting on this speaker for the whole retreat. Unfortunately, it was never turned on at the speaker. That was discovered last night. So talk about a delusion. I was speaking thinking my voice was being amplified, and it never was. So if I sound a little funny this morning, it is because I am now amplified. So it's when you attach to these reflected traces of past experience, then you produce delusion. Okay, and I found something else where he goes more into. But basically, just to continue here, he says we retain the things we saw and heard in the past, and when they come up, they appear as traces in our consciousness and our awareness, and are just reflected there. Right. That's all that's going on. But these things have no substance. They're just reflections, okay? Past events, past feelings, past issues, I mean, all that stuff. So they just arise in the mind, and they just kind of appear in the mirror of our mind. And at this point he says they're just reflections. Okay? But then what happens? He says if we just let them be reflected, if we just let them arise and just let them arise, if we just let them stop, they'll stop. As long as we're not attaching to these reflective traces, delusions won't be produced. So as long as you're not attaching to them, you won't be deluded. And then no matter how many traces are reflected, it will be just as if they weren't reflected at all. Even if 100, even if 1,000 thoughts spring up, it will be the same as if they never arose. It won't be any problem for you. No thoughts to clear away. No thoughts to cut off. And this he's referring to practices that people do. You know, in some traditions, even Buddhist one, you know, we clear away our delusive thoughts. Right? It's an active process. Or in other ones, we cut them off, like Manjusri Sof, just using your koan, you just cut them off. Here he says you don't need to do any of that. You don't need to sweep them away. You don't need to cut them off. All you do is just not to attach to them. Okay. So let me before I comment on, let me just read. Here he says, the reason people misunderstand the difference between thoughts and delusions is that everyone imagines thoughts all exist at the bottom and arise from there. But originally, there's no actual substance at the bottom from which thoughts arise. So I think he's whether it was a belief or a sense that somehow, you know, there's a place, you know, the bottom of my mind, and these thoughts, you know, these things are arising up, right? But he says there's no actual substance, right? Substance means something that has substance, something that has you can touch, you can feel, you can see, right? It has substance. He said there's no place like that, right? Thoughts don't arise from anything that has any substance. It's very important, right? Instead, you retain the things you see and hear from time to time in response to circumstances. The impressions created by these experiences are reflected back to you in precise detail. Right? So this is the whole Buddhist idea of the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana, and that traces of all our experiences are there, and they're always just popping up. Right? And they're either just kind of popping up on a random basis into consciousness, or else more particularly when circumstances occur, they'll, you know, that somehow remind us of unconsciously or whatever, or feel like or seem like or whatever. They just, all of a sudden, those traces of past experiences kind of just arise. Okay? That's all that's going on. Nothing of substance is going on, is he? at this point in the early stages, when these traces of past experience, past feelings, past whatever are arising, they just arise as a trace. It's like a sense, a trace. You know, a trace is nothing of any substance, but it's something that's somewhat identifiable, right? A trace of something. He says that's all it is. So when they're reflected in your mind, just let them be and refrain from attaching to them. Even if evil thoughts, bad thoughts, painful thoughts, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them, and they cannot help but stop. Isn't this just the same as if they didn't arise? In that way, there will not be any bad thoughts for you to drive out forcibly, or any remorse about having had them. Very different way. Right? Very different way. Very direct, very simple, and it is a way of managing feelings, thoughts, memories, issues that is totally devoid of a self doing anything. Basically, what we do is we are constantly managing, manipulating, dealing with, being affected by, healing, etc., these things that have been created by self, and it is often self, it always is self, that is doing the work. Right? It is always in the process of cleaning up its own mess that it created. And then it takes the credit for it. Right? Look how wise I've become. Right? You know? I used to cause suffering to myself, and now all I do is heal and create good for myself. Aren't I a good self now? I mean, so what he's saying is, you know, even though it obviously feels better and seems better, I don't think he would deny that, even though I don't know, Bonke's kind of an all-or-nothing kind of guy. But he's saying is, it's still within the world of self. And he's saying there is another way, where you understand that all these things have no substance. Right? And if they arise, they're only arising because there are traces left in our consciousness from past experiences. That's why they're arising. And if we just let them be, which is very hard. Why is it very hard? We're very attached to them. Why are we very attached to them? Because we claim them as what? My stuff. It's my stuff, right? My issues, my garbage, my pain, my screw-ups, you know, right? My fears, my loneliness. It's, you know, we claim it all. Self claims it all for itself, and so therefore it's a big deal to it, right? And he's saying what? There is another way. There's no self involved in any of it. There's no self involved in what's arising, and there's no self involved in how it's, in who's handling it. It's just a very clear, objective process. Okay? Because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, mental impressions from the past are reflected, and you make the mistake of labeling as delusions things that aren't delusions at all. Now, just pay attention here, because he's explaining what he means when in these words. Delusion means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. Okay, do you hear that? According to Bonke, delusion is the thought, is the anguish of thought feeding on thought. Does everybody know from their own experience what he's talking about? Right? So he's saying what he calls the delusion that is the cause of our suffering comes because we start chaining thoughts together. Right? And when they're chained together in a certain way, they produce what? Anguish, suffering. And he calls that delusion. But he's describing, you know, for those who understand, this is, there's no content in this. It's just a process that we do that causes us to suffer. Right. So he's saying, if you do not link the thoughts, if you do not let the traces that arise become thoughts, the thoughts begin to chain together, we would call that what? Or we'd call it, creating a story, let's say. You know, we haven't gotten to obsession yet. As we get more sophisticated, we start it. But if you see, he's talking about a process in which, thoughts, right? And we know what people were saying yesterday. We have thoughts passing through our mind all the time. I mean, Alex says, how many thoughts you already had today, Alex?
Well, the average person has 20,000 to 30,000.
Yeah.
And I'm on retreat, and it's 4 hours into it, so maybe I've had 10,000.
Okay, so Alex has had 10,000 already. But this is important. What he's saying is, many of these thoughts, we might say, were just traces. They were just kind of blips passing through. And a number of them were maybe a little more elaborated, but they just were thoughts. But what he's talking about delusion, which is really what covers our Buddha mind, right, so completely, is when these thoughts, right, and these traces and thoughts begin to link together, right, creating story. And I'm just trying to update it. And probably story now has gone into a drama, right? Because remember, a story is somewhat benign. I mean, we can weave stories in our head that are just kind of stories. You know, this and that, and that, you know, future, past. Again, those are coverings of the mind, and they should be dispensed with because they're not needed. But those are stories. But there is something much more pernicious that we do, which is we create drama. And the drama, a drama is involved with what? Yeah, and because always in a drama, if you think about drama, there's always a protagonist and an antagonist, right? So there's me versus you, or them, or, right? And now we have characters. So now we have a drama. We no longer have a story, right? We have a drama. And depending on how we weave that drama, we then have what? Emotional affliction, anger, resentment, hurt, fear, worry, sadness, despair. You know what I mean? Can you see? And now we are what? We are deep in delusion that is created by the self. Because as Bhante said, all delusion, all the drama, has as its central character who? And I may be running a drama, I think we like to run dramas where we're the victim. That's kind of our favorite as dramatists. We like to write it that way. So we're either the victim of other people, or the hero. We're going to make things right, and we're going to tell people what's really right, and we're going to straighten it all out. But so we're either the victim or we're the hero, right? But it becomes a drama, right? And as Jessica said, then because we are so unable to control this mind, once we get a juicy drama going, even though it is causing anguish, right? We then keep replaying it. Right? Over and over and over and over again. Thus creating what? Yeah, or suffering. And we play it until what? Until we can play it no more. Right? We've milked this one for all we can get. And then who knows? We may be kind enough to ourselves to give us a little respite, for a little respite for a few hours. Right? And then what? And then we start up again. Something will either pop in. It doesn't have to be even happening. The trace can just appear when we're doing something else, right? Trace, thought, 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 chain, story, drama, anguish, obsession. Right? And we're off to the races. Until we've played it out, right? And then we rest. And then we start over again. And thus, years go by. Decades go by. Right? So this is important to remember what he means. He says, what foolishness it is to create the anguish of delusion by changing the precious Buddha mind, pondering over this and that, mulling over things of no worth. Right? He discovered this in a cave, the truth of this. Changing our precious Buddha mind, pondering over this and that. Isn't that what we do? We ponder over this and that, mulling over things of no worth. Right? Everybody in this room has mulled over. Alex, how many things have you mulled over in your lifetime? I'm just using you because you see somebody who keeps track of these things. How many things do you think you've mulled over in your lifetime?
As many stars in the universe.
Okay. And even with that, you may be minimizing. And if I said to you, Alex, of all these myriad of things you've mulled over in your lifetime, can you remember how many of them were of real worth?
Yeah, I'd say I made a bad investment.
Right, bad, okay. So we all know this, don't we? It's funny and yet it's tragic. Because it is a waste of time. It oftentimes leads to our own anguish within ourselves and others, and at the same time we miss, you know, all the goodness that is going on in life, that is accessible and available to us. You know, this I tell you, Bankei. He's a man who knew us. If there were anyone who actually succeeded at something by pondering it all the way through, it might be all right to do things that way. But I've never heard of anyone who in the end was able to accomplish anything like this. So pondering over things is useless. Isn't it? And then he says it again, it's utterly useless, exclamation point. The main thing is always to be careful not to stir up thoughts and change the unborn Buddha mind for a fighting demon, a hell dweller, a hungry ghost, a beast, and the like. He's very clear, isn't he? But you understand the psychology of it. I mean, he's revealing very simply the process that goes on in our minds, how we can begin at ease in our life, in our day, right? And how unconsciously, you know, these traces, these random thoughts, for some reason, we attach to, we begin to link. And before we know, we've linked them into a story. And before we know, that story has become a drama. And before we know it, there's all kinds of emotional affliction, and right? and we're thick in it. Right? The cloud, you know, these are not light little fluffy clouds in which you can kind of still see the blue sky through it. Right? These are thick, dark clouds. Right? You cannot see the sun, and you cannot see the sky, and it is dark. We all know what it's like when there's a thick cloud cover. Even in the daylight, it can be dark. Right? And if there are those dark rain, thunder clouds, it can be quite dark, right? Even in the middle of the day. It can be quite dark. And that's what happens to our minds. We get dark. The darkness comes over us. We all know that. So he's saying, please understand this well. And then here's another thing I wanted to read. This is a nice one, because somebody was asking, you know, well, did anybody get it when he was teaching, you know, or can you really put this into practice? So this one is called The Old Nurse from Sanuki. And so this is Bankei talking. He says, let me tell you about, so this must be from a larger something or other. Let me tell you about something in this connection. When I was giving a sermon at Marugame in Sanuki, everyone in town showed up, and there was a huge crowd. The lady of a samurai retainer came with a maid servant and her old nurse, and after hearing my instruction, went home. Later, this lady and her nurse came again, and this time the lady said to me, before meeting your reverence, referring to Bankei, my nurse was continually short-tempered and willful, ready to fly into a rage at the slightest thing. But ever since she heard your instructions that day, in spite of all the time that has passed, she hasn't lost her temper once. What's more, she says only sensible things these days and does not let her mind dwell at all on useless matters. The result is that I myself have now come to feel ashamed before my nurse. Obviously, saying, you know, I mean, I have not made the same progress in my life that my old nurse did. She seems to have completely grasped your reverence's teaching. And as I believe is particularly thanks to you, both she and I are ever grateful. And then he adds, even afterwards, when I happened to hear about her, everyone told me that she never again strayed into delusion. So even an old, uneducated nurse, right, hearing Bankei once, got it. Right? Went home and made her commitment, I'm just not going to go there anymore. Right? And the nurse, and she says she's a transformed woman, that even her high-born lady is ashamed before her. And here's another one on thoughts. Again, I tried to pick things today that speak right to practice. Since our retreat's coming to an end and we're all going to be on our own, it's important that we get this very clearly. Again, since the unborn Buddha mind. And again, the unborn Buddha mind, you could just call it the Buddha mind. Okay? The unborn is something he adds to show that it is not a mind that has ever been created. Right? It always is. Right? Nobody or anything ever made it happen or made it come into existence. So that's why he calls it unborn. Right? As opposed to our thinking conceptual mind, where it's clear, something arises, it passes, arises, you know. Mind states come and go. He said, this, you know, I mean, you can be unhappy now, but you can remember when you were happy. You can be angry now, but you can remember when you weren't angry, right? You know, but he says, this mind is nothing like that. It always just is. It's the mirror. It's not the things that appear in the mirror. So he says, since this unborn Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, it hasn't so much as a hair's breadth of any selfish bias. Okay, remember the mirror, right? The mirror is not biased toward itself as a mirror, right? Nor is it biased toward anything that appears in it, It just perfectly reflects whatever appears in. So he's saying this is the basic ground awareness of the mind. Well, of the mind, then it just is. Okay. So it doesn't have a hair's breadth of any selfish bias. So it adapts itself freely as it encounters different sorts of circumstances, thoughts sporadically pop up. Okay. So I think what he's implying here is this, this mirror mind of ours, as it goes through circumstances, it's just present to whatever's happening. And then because of our own causes and conditions in the past and our own learning, in relationship to what is appearing, thoughts appear, right? Traces appear based on past experience or whatever, learning, right? So he's kind of describing what we might say is kind of our everyday experience. Before what we talked about earlier, before thoughts become linked, before thoughts become stories and stories become dramas, and then he's just saying on every day, this awareness, this mirror mind, is just, going through the day, dealing with circumstances that arise, and because of causes and conditions, thought traces, different sensations will just arise. Okay? It's all right, so long as you simply don't get involved with them. Is important. So the idea that somehow, I can't have thoughts, I got to get rid of thoughts, all the stuff we struggle with, he's not saying that at all, is he? He's saying, because of, just living in life and families and learning English and going to school and speaking to people, we have a thinking mind, and that in response to situations as we come across them, thoughts will arise. So he says that's don't focus on that. Like that's not the problem, right? He said let them arise. Don't get involved with them. And then but if you do get involved with thoughts and go on developing them, you won't be able to stop. Does anybody notice that? Right? It's like people who are binge eaters, it's like they start before you, or binge drinkers, they can't stop, right? And not binge eaters, binge drinkers, they can't stop. So we're kind of binge thinkers. Right? Once we start, we cannot let it go. Right? Just give me more and more and more and more. More of those thoughts, more elaboration, more obsession. We're binge thinkers. Right? That's what he's saying. We cannot stop. And he says that you won't be able to stop. Why? Because you get the energy going now. What?
Quicksand.
Right? Once you start shoveling it in, right? Once you get the spoon, and once you get the hunger, and once you get the quart of ice cream in front of you, right? It's like, right? The people like that. They cannot stop until finally they hit the bottom. Then all of a sudden they realize they can stop. Right? But as long as they see a little bit left in there, right? They can't stop, right? We laugh. But he's saying this is the way we are. It's like we can't stop. Right? Binge thinkers, binge dramatists. Right? Once we start the drama, we gotta write it all the way through. Right? And then you'll what's the problem? Not only that you're creating this delusion, but you're obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of the Buddha mind as you create these delusions. So he's saying, two things. One is you're creating this delusion and this anguish and this, but the other thing again is you're obscuring. Now you can't even see it, can you? Totally lost contact with it. Right. Totally lost, totally alone, stuck in your drama, right? And that sense of wholeness, that sense of covenant, that sense of wellness, that sense of connection, right? That you might have felt earlier in the day. Totally gone. Well, where'd it go? It's covered up. What's it covered up by? Delusions. What created the delusions? We linked. Traces to thought, to thought, to thought, to memories of this, to feelings. On the other hand, since from the start the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, readily illuminating, distinguishing all things, when you hate and loathe these deluded thoughts that come up and try to stop them, you get caught up in stopping them. Right? Okay. Right? Many people who come to retreat know about that. I've got to stop these thoughts. And the more you try to stop them, you know, now you've got another whole train going, right? Of stopping the thoughts, not wanting the thoughts, getting rid of the thoughts, can't stand the thoughts, frustrated by the thoughts, disgusted by the thoughts, disgusted by yourself, right? Steve's going, yeah, I know that one. Yeah, and it's, again, he, you know, this is the other side of it, right? You know, he's saying if you attach to it, and you follow it, you know, you just create this, you know, elaborate delusion. On the other hand, if you're saying, no, I'm going to fight it. I'm not going to give in to it. I'm going to stop it. He said, you're also energizing it. And before you know it, you have another battle going on. Right. You get caught up in stopping them and create a duality between the one who is doing the stopping and that which is being stopped. Important. We're creating duality. We're seeing the thoughts as something. I am going to stop my thoughts. As if I am real, the thoughts are real. I mean, it's all, can you see the duality? The two-ness, the separation. So again, he says, if you try to stop a thought with thought, there will never be an end to it. And again, he says, it's just like trying to wash away blood with blood. We know that one now. We know him. Even if you succeeded in getting out the original blood, you'll be left with the stain of the blood that came after. Here's a good one. Are you ready for this one? I thought I'd save this one for the end, or toward the end. Okay, because I didn't think the first 2 days you'd be ready, but now kind of Bunke has softened us up enough that he can give the, you know, the final blow. And Bunke says, I tell my students, and those of you coming regularly here to the temple, be stupid. This is his pith instruction. Be stupid. So if there's anybody here over the course of their life has ever called themselves stupid, you should feel happy to know. that there is somebody who approves of your stupidity. You're already there. Okay? There's other people here may go, I'm going to have to really work at being stupid. But there are other people here who said, oh my God, I've been calling myself stupid my whole life. I don't know. This practice will be easy for me. So I tell my students, and those of you coming here regularly, here to the temple, be stupid. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh now, he's always doing these things. You go to retreat, he's, you know, they're selling all these little calligraphies. I don't think he's ever done that one. But as you know, he will do them on demand these days. You tell the monks and the nuns who do it, and the next day or an hour later, he'll have one ready for you. So if somebody wants to have him do one called "Be Stupid," I think that'd be a nice one. We can bring it to retreat and put it up. All right, because you've got the dynamic function of the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind. Even if you get rid of discriminative understanding, you will not be foolish. You will not be foolish. So all of you, from here on, be stupid. Even if you're stupid, when you're hungry, you'll ask for something to eat. Right? When you're thirsty, you'll ask for some tea. When it gets warm, you'll put on thin, light clothes. And when it's cold, you'll put on more clothes. Right? As far as your general activities of what you do every day, you're not lacking a thing. So he said, even though you're stupid, which means you no longer think you know everything, right? You're stupid. He said, still, you won't be foolish. You'll still be able to get up in the morning and brush your teeth and go to the bathroom and drive your car and you know, you'll be able to take care of everything. Right? You just won't think you're that smart anymore. And then he goes on. With people who are clever, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. And I say this because somehow I think we're in a room here with lots of clever people. As I'm sure Banca, as he looked around his audience, in the 16th century, looked around and thought, here I am, you know, all these clever people interested in this teaching are here. Said, with people who are clever, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. To have transcended those clever people whom all the world holds in great esteem is what's meant by, quote-unquote, stupidity. There's really nothing wrong with being a blockhead. When people say someone is a clever person, I ask to meet them, Bunke says. And when I do and we have a chance to talk, it looks to me if the people in the world are praising an awful lot of foolishness. The fact is that those clever people acclaimed by the world are from the start deluded by their own cleverness. They distort the Buddha mind and obscure its marvelously illuminating dynamic function. And furthermore, consider other people as of no account, contradicting whatever anybody else says, slighting and insulting them. Sounds like talk radio. Right. Full of clever people, talking heads. I'm right, you're wrong. Yeah, I mean, I'm smarter, Bill's is an idiot. You know, this is what passes for intelligence in our world these days. Contradicting what they say, slighting, insulting them. Since those they're insulting are also amply endowed with the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind. Remember what he said, has no picking or choosing, right? It becomes, you know, whatever people take it. So he's saying, over here, these very clever people are now putting down everybody who disagrees with them. But then over on the other side, everybody else who disagrees with them, their marvelously illuminating Buddha mind is clearly reflecting what's coming at them. They're getting their own thought forms linked together. They have their traces coming up. And before you know it, what are they up to? They aren't going to let themselves be slighted like that. So they get angry and answer right back, heedlessly pouring forth abuse. Sounds like Congress. I mean, it sounds like the Florida Senate and House of Representatives. I mean, you're right, they're off and running, right? Heaping abuse on each other, right? All these people who think they're so smart, so clever, right? Our world is filled with them, right? Right? Our corporations are filled with them, our armed services are, all the leaders feel what? They know it all. They're so clever. Right? And everybody disagrees with him as just an idiot. Or, and they're all just heaping abuse on one another. Right? Slandering one another. Putting each other down. Right? We live in dark times. Yeah. All right. Is that clear? Right? And I say that, I mean, it's easy to point the finger, but we have to also admit that we're a little bit like that too, aren't we? There are many of us here who think we're quite clever and that we have all the answers, right? And those who don't share our fond opinions, what? Are all wrong, right? And the world would be probably better off without them in the world, right? But since we've taken vows of nonviolence, we don't go on the rampage, as we really would like to. But we just kind of in our own minds harbor thoughts like this, right? So the very little separates us, unfortunately, from the person who takes up the gun, right? Just a little impulse control. Now he says, the true person's ideal is to show kindness to those who are foolish and help those who are evil. So what is our purpose in life? To be kind to people, even if they're foolish. And those who are creating suffering in the world for themselves and others, to help them. We're not here to judge. We're not here to insult, right? We're here to be kind and to help, you know, to bring clarity, right? Where there's only confusion, right? To bring reconciliation and understanding where there's only divisiveness. To be recognized as a good person by the people of the world is precisely what makes being born a human being worthwhile. Right? Very simple, right? This is, you know, this is what. Instead, what? You know, we want to be recognized as what? As a powerful person, as a wealthy person, as a, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? And he says, no. You know, we want the world to recognize it through our goodness. Our goodness means what? Right? Our capacity to be kind and our capacity to be helpful. Right? Those are the things to be known for, not for all these other things. You know, how big your house is, or how expensive your car is, or how many, you know what I mean? All that stuff. Right? All that stuff that the world honors so these days. Nonsense. How can it be any good to earn yourself the reputation of a wicked person? So then he says, so when you go back to your homes, and soon you'll be going back to your homes and meet your old acquaintances, you should have them wondering about you all. Quote, how did Bankei teach them Buddhism anyway? Why, they've come back even more stupid than before they left. What I'm talking about isn't the stupidity of stupidity and understanding. That which transcends stupidity and understanding is what I mean by stupidity. Very profound. He's not talking about a stupidity that stands apart from understanding. He's talking about something that transcends that, much deeper than that. Right. Hmm. So let me, I'll end the Dharma talk today with this last paragraph from one of Bankei's teaching. The master addressed the assembly. For one who at all times conclusively realizes the Buddha mind, when she goes to bed, she goes to bed with the Buddha mind. When she gets up with the Buddha mind. When he stays with the Buddha mind, and when he goes with the Buddha mind. When she sits with the Buddha mind, and when she stands with the Buddha mind. When he sleeps with the Buddha mind, and when he wakes up with the Buddha mind. When she speaks with the Buddha mind. When she's silent with the Buddha mind. When he drinks rice, when he eats with the Buddha mind, and when he drinks tea, he drinks with the Buddha mind. When she puts on her clothes, she puts them on with the Buddha mind. At all times, abide continually in the Buddha mind, and there it will not be a single moment when you're not in the Buddha mind. Then you can function with perfect freedom in accordance with all circumstances, letting things just take their own way. Just do good things and don't do bad things. If you pride yourself on your good deeds, however, becoming attached to them and abominating the bad, that's going against the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is neither good nor bad, but operates beyond them both. Isn't that the living Buddha mind? When you've conclusively realized this and haven't any doubts, then and there you'll open the eye that penetrates all beings' minds. That's why my school, this is Bankei talking, this is why my school is called, this must be what he called his school, the clear-eyed school of Zen. Clear-eyed school of Zen. So that's Zen Master Bankei. Please take him home with you. Leaving him here at the Franciscan Center will not help you one iota. You need to take him home, take his teachings home, make him your companion, hear his words inside you, instructing you, guiding you, supporting you. Any questions about the practices that Bankei has shared with us? Anything not clear about how to practice him? Just make sure you're clear. And if there's anybody here who's thinking, too difficult for me, right? Remember the old nurse. Right? Remember the old nurse. Just a simple woman. No education. Probably knew nothing about Buddhism, knew nothing about philosophy, nothing about, right? She came, she listened, it made sense to her. She went home, put it into practice. Yes?
What did he say to do when you get to the point of obsession?
When you get to the point of obsession, no, you don't want to. You don't want to get to the point of obsession. You know. What do you do when you've gotten? You know, when you've eaten the whole half gallon of ice cream. You know, you're sick, right? I mean, of course, you know, stop whenever you can, right? But you know what you're talking about is the unfortunate. You know, this is where we begin. Oftentimes, we only realize that we're causing our suffering at the end, right? When we're knee-deep in it, you know, the wreckage is all around, and all of a sudden, you know, we have a moment of clarity, and we go, holy, you know, I've done it again. Okay. I mean, obviously, you know, that is better than somebody who just, you know, just keeps on going. Like a mad animal, you know, after attacking one animal, looks around for somebody else to attack, right? I mean, stopping and seeing the damage you've done, and having some remorse, you know, remorse meaning, you know, that is good. But, I mean, at that point, you know, you're already knee-deep in it, right? I mean, like he says, you know, I mean, when we said earlier, I mean, it's hard, when once it gets going too much, as we all know, it's hard, it has an energy of its own, right? And you find, not only do you not listen to yourself, but even if there's somebody around you who half an hour ago you loved and trusted, you don't listen to them, right? I mean, it's just, we're just off to the races, right? And unfortunately, that's the way it is, unfortunately. You know, all we can do is what? You know, at the end of which, you know, try again to understand what it is that hooks us, right? To review the practice again, you know, to make, you know, begin anew, to make the commitment to do better next time and get clear when this arises, how you want to handle it. And, again, I mean, most of us are not mad people. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, we're not just totally whacked out of control, just raging, and just running from one profound or destructive emotion to another, you know, without a second in between, right? I mean, there are people like hell like this, but you know, I would imagine most of us aren't. I mean, right? I've noticed that most of you, at least outwardly, have been able to keep it together for the last 3 days. Good sign. So you know, without knowing what's going on inside, at least it's a sign that outwardly, we have some capability, right? Again, I think this is where understanding the teachings and making a commitment, right? You know, if you think about other types of addictions, substance abuse, alcoholism, food addictions, I mean, we know. The bottom line is the commitment not to use again, no matter what you feel like doing, right? I mean, that's a commitment. If you don't have that commitment, you're dead, right? Because you will feel like doing it, you will want to do it, you'll have a strong impulse to do it, right? Those will still continue, right? The only thing in the early stages that will keep you straight is the commitment, no matter what. And then, there are things you can do, you know. But the bottom line, all the things you do come from that commitment not to go down that path again. Strong commitment. And everybody here can make that commitment. It's just we don't want to make that commitment because we haven't gotten it yet. Still think we're justified in doing what we do, even though it's very clear when in our more rational moments that it's just causing us suffering, right? Or causing suffering to others, or that it's an illusion, or that when the fog clears, we become very wise again, right? When we can see our situation objectively. But we get into it and we're off. Now again, over time through the practice of meditation, mindfulness, the teaching, learning to be more kind, compassionate, thinking, you know what I mean, there is a softening, right? And that occurs, luckily. But again, that process, can be speeded up. By being a person who has a strong aspiration and is willing to make a strong commitment along with that aspiration. Right? Many of us have good aspirations, but we have very limited commitment. Right? You know, it's like to say to yourself, let's say you're somebody. Who your thing is anger, and you know that when you get angry, and let's say specifically with a person maybe that you love and care about, you know that when you get angry, you say things to them that are that causes harm, that later you regret. You make a vow: no matter how angry I get, I'm not going to open my mouth. All right, just don't open that mouth. Right? Even if you got to, you know, reach for the duct tape. Right? I'm not going to do it anymore. I don't, you know how strong the impulse is to tell that person what I think of them. And blah, 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 you know, I'm not going to do it because I know it causes suffering. How do I know? Because I've done it how many times? So it's like that. Now that's, you know, that takes commitment. But the commitment is in relationship to your awareness of how much suffering that kind of action causes, and in relationship to your aspiration to be a different kind of person, not to be a person who causes suffering to another. You know, somebody who has that great aspiration would rather put duct tape over their mouth than say harmful words to another human being. Something like that. Any other questions about practice? Yes.
There's a saying I've heard, first thought, best thought.
Mm-hmm.
If the Buddha mind reveals to us how to respond in a situation, what is needed, what's appropriate. Maybe it speaks to us in the form of a thought, or maybe it doesn't.
I mean,
what I'm trying to get to.
What are you trying to get to?
Is in practice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you distinguish that first thought, best thought, that is the Buddha mind is revealing to us from the beginning of a whole chain of useless, unnecessary thoughts, you know, of the binge thinker?
Yeah, well, again, please notice that Bankei did not give that teaching. First thought, best thought. That was never taught by him. And the only time I ever heard is a relationship to kind of poetry or to the creative process. You know, Bankei is very clear, right? Best thought, worst thought, whatever the thought is, let it be. You know, that is your capacity to understand is deeper than thought. Your capacity to respond appropriately to the situation does not need, you know, the mediation of thought. That's what he's saying over. I mean, he gives the example. I mean, you know, a sound occurs and you go to it. You know, your Buddha mind just goes to it. It just hears it and it knows what it is. It cannot be fooled. He says, you know, something is complicated. You know, you're walking down New York City streets and the people coming at you all, and you don't have to think. It just naturally, you go left, you go right, you stop. Your feet speed up, your legs slow down. You know. Without the mediation of thought. So, you know, it's just showing that we have an amazing capacity to deal with situations without thinking first, right? Learn to trust that. Learn to trust that. Learn to live from that. That's why in Zen traditionally, spontaneous activities, natural activities, things that just, you know, but it's not necessarily about thought, because as you say, you know, I mean, all kinds of thoughts arise. Again, you know, the practice also involves, you know, I mean, I was talking to somebody, or a group or something, and I went back and checked it. But Bankei had his enlightenment experience, you know, his first enlightenment experience, in the cave there with the when he was 24, but he didn't really actively teach, you know, and really didn't become well known the way he did for nearly 30-40 years later. Okay, so please understand, it wasn't like, you know, it just happens. You know, I mean, there were years also of practice, and also it means life. And learning how to put this into practice, right? So, I guess what I'm saying, you know, At the same time, even if you take Bankei Zen as the kind of ground of practice, but you're also still practicing the six paramitas, you're also still following the bodhisattva path, you're still cultivating mind, you know what I mean? So there's a process of transformation also going on, right? Learning, as he says, to be kind and helpful to beings is always to be thinking of yourself. I mean, that's, capacity not to be, to live a life totally self-centered is a process. Right? It's a learning process. And it also involves a lot of, sort of what Susan was saying. I mean, those kind of practices where you clearly see that so much of your actions are just stemming from clearly from self, right? And making a commitment no longer to live from that place. I mean, he says, what covers, what's the biggest cover of our Buddha mind, or what, is self-centeredness. And the process of softening and eventually alleviating and eventually eliminating, the domination of self and self, centeredness, is a process. And as in our tradition and our community, we did, last year we did a whole intensive on investigation into the nature of self and into the skandhas. I mean, all these things help. Loosen our fixation that self is real and solid and permanent, and so it's all working to the same end. Okay. Yes, and then we have to stop.
There was talk about using the mirror. To see that you hear, you see, you feel, you have thoughts, but I don't recall mental states.
Everything is reflected in the mirror. Everything. This is the ground of your mind. This is your Buddha mind. This is your unborn. But there's nothing outside it, because it reflects everything. It is awareness. Right? And, you can just imagine that, you see a house and it has all these windows and doors, The light's on in the house. Right? It's all lit up. Right? It's nighttime. Every window and door is open. So light is coming out of everyone. Every window, every door. Why? Because of the light that's in the house. That's lighting up everything. It's illuminating everything. So, it's 11:15, and our next agenda is to have our closing circle. Let me just say, before Alex pulls the mic away from me, in a certain sense, you are now about to enter the most difficult part of the retreat, which is returning home. Whether this retreat has been a breeze for you, and you're thinking right now, I can't believe 3 days have gone by, or whether this was a, a grinding ordeal. Either way, it's over. And whatever your experience has been, it's been an experience. And through these 3 days of practice, and through these 3 days of Dharma talks, and the guided meditations, and the yoga, I mean, you have been nourished, and you have been opened in many ways. Everyone here. But now you're going to go home. And your daily life, your home life, all has the same energy there that when you left. Okay? The only thing that may be different is you. Is that clear? So if you want, if being on retreat away from your daily life has given you insights and understandings about your life and how you want to live and change, right? It is not going to happen by itself. I assure you, everything in your life has continued the same. Okay? Okay? The only thing that's different is maybe you. So you need to understand that if there are any shifts or changes that you want to bring into your life, you're going to have to bring them, right? Which means you're going to have to be very conscious and very clear in implementation. Okay. This is where many people lose it. Like organizational change, it's on the implementation that it falls down. Great ideas, but without implementation, they just stay great ideas, right? So, we're just going to take a short break, and then we're going to have our closing circle. And what I'm going to be asking everyone, and this time we are going to go around and hear from everyone, but only have a couple of minutes for everyone. But what I really want you to reflect on your retreat, and pick out one, two, three of the things that are most meaningful to you that you want to take home with you. Right, but you want to take home with you and bring into your life. And I want each of us to say it publicly so we can hear it. Right? So, but that's the key thing. So really, because, you know, we can't take home everything. And very few of us live in retreat environments and have a daily schedule like this and, you know, have 35 other people around to support us, right? So this is unusual. So we're going back into our life. So I want you to, you might have had lots of different experiences and insights and that, but pick out two or three that you want to take home with you and implement, okay? And we'll have a couple of minutes for everybody. We'll go around and we'll hear from everybody. So let's have a five-minute break, and you want to invite the bell.